can hear. What would you like to ask or say or do? Yes, please.
It goes to the poem you
yes.
Spoke to yesterday. This question of when you love something that is different.
Yes.
How it can cost us everything, and whether that's a negative or a positive.
Mm.
I'm assuming it's a positive,
mm.
But I feel like a lot of devotional aspects of ourselves can be pathologized today, and
mm-hmm.
we implicate suffering in worthiness. How to differentiate between the punishing part that is worthwhile and the part that is what you speak about, just the blessing of being, if you can be.
Could you hear? Oh well. She's very eloquent. I've forgotten the word in Hebrew.
Rehuta.
Rahut.
Rehuta.
What?
Rehuta.
Rehuta. She's very rehuta. Kol rehuta. So from the poem yesterday, if you remember, or should I read it again, or? If I were eloquent in your language, I would try to tell you how it is when something difficult loves you, how it is when you begin to love it back, how this can cost you everything. Or I don't know if it's cost you or cost, but anyway, cost everything, I think. I think that's basically the poem. So let's see. I think it's more than one question in there, but maybe the main thing is how to tell the difference between pain and suffering that is not useful, actually. But you're talking about it as specifically suffering that we think will buy worthiness. Is that correct? So where we have programming that we have the feeling that we have to work to earn a place. And so we feel confirmed by that suffering. We feel, well, at least I'm suffering in order to buy my place here. Compared to what in the poem, it's the word difficult. It's not actually suffering or pain. It's difficult. So how can we differentiate, how can we discern between these two kinds of difficulty? Is that a good enough summary?
Mm-hmm.
Is there something left out that's important to start with?
Perhaps just the aspect of devotion.
Oh yeah, right. Okay. Yeah. That's really the heart of the question, actually. So, okay. So, I would say, I'm now putting it into my words, we have an ambivalence culturally, which is, ambivalence means yes and no. And I'm glad to use this, have this word come up, because already from the first evening, we're talking about finding a place in ourselves where there's yes and no to what we actually need and love. Yes and no. A barrier to what would be nourishment, a barrier to what would be wholesome expression, different kinds of barrier. Different kinds of, where there's a no, N-O, in an inappropriate place. So it's not that no doesn't have a place, but we have it in this place where it's blocking. I want love, but when there's love, I shut down. Or I run away. for example, or a freezer or whatever. I want freedom, but actually I'm freaked out by freedom. And I'm okay, you can find your own thing there. So there's an ambivalence. There's a yes and no in our culture, but especially a no, N-O, about devotion. This is now coming back to Yael's question. There's a sense that, yeah, so what is devotion in Hebrew? Better to, you surely have a word.
Mesirut. We don't actually. Mesirut.
All right. Well, Ruth. Ruth, we can say Ruth. As one part of devotion. So Yael is saying, culturally, we pathologize devotion. So we consider devotion to be something wrong. It must be my neurosis if I'm expressing devotion. And also situations where it might kind of look like devotion often are sick as well. And so we have this big conflict because there are so many headlines about situations that could have been about devotion and were pathology, were sickness, abuse, etc. And then we have sort of like where devotion would try to grow and sprout, and then this big cloud against it, that it would be wrong. So we have a fear of feeling lower than, and something is higher than, if I'm devoted to. We have, we're complicated about humility and pride. We're complicated about will and self-determination or determination. We're complicated about cooperation, collaboration. We're complicated about leadership. So all different kinds of branches that would be part of devotion. We're complicated about it all, culturally. And because the culture is complicated about leadership and following and love and surrender and moving in a way that maybe we're not asking it to make sense first, we're trusting that we might see the beauty of it afterwards with different eyes. So, and maybe especially there's a complication where maybe an aspect of devotion is exactly this theme about unconditioned, unconditionality. Because there, maybe devotion is a good word for where we actually, we do give everything and we aren't expecting something back. We're not bargaining, we're not negotiating. And this is culturally so hampered, so burdened. The kind of places that we feel maybe culturally allowed still to do something that's not for profit is parenting. And maybe, depending on your family, if your parents aren't well, maybe you could take care of them. I'm not sure there's any other place that it's like, yeah, right, oh yeah, you're a parent. It might be different in Israel, but in general, the so-called Western culture, which is the sort of dominant thing, I have noticed that parenting seems to be the one place that, with some reservations, with some holding back, okay, yeah, you can do something that's not for profit. for your personal profit, how that consensual reality about what profit is. So that means the common view of what is profit. We don't even, aren't even invited to check what would be actual profit. So that would be how I feel devotion and the complications about it. So there'll be a few things that are actually in my notes in my pocket, but so keep bringing me back to your question for the parts that I'll miss with this. Okay, so one thing that happens about now, about today on retreat, is that people start to come with this idea that either they're enjoying or not enjoying doing nothing. And doing nothing is considered to be what the teachers have told you to do. And I don't think that either of us have said that at all, even once. And so it's just to get how we're in this geological rift, and to get how our collective tendency to land over here or over there. So if we're not doing things in the normal way, they must be saying not to do anything. So, okay, what do I think about doing nothing? I like it, I don't like it, I don't understand it, I don't accept it. And then, luckily, you have the chance, you can come and ask, or someone else ask, so I can bring the question here. Did you hear me say do nothing? Even once. It could be that it could come out of my mouth. Is it possible to do nothing?
No.
Does that exist? Is that in any card, deck of cards, while living?
Yeah.
And so then we come back into the rift between what we thought was two opposites of doing and not doing. So compared to the normal way of doing, we're not doing anything. But we're not doing anything. What's happening? And so it happens almost every retreat that I give in the first meditation about 10 different instructions that you could choose from. In the second meditation, maybe 5 more. And then people say, yeah, but I don't understand what we're supposed to be doing. You haven't given any instructions. And I'm not blaming you at all. This is just, because what we're talking in the rift. We're not talking consensual reality. We're not talking how people normally talk, how we've gotten used to talking.
Rift?
What is
it?
Rift.
Zem. Shesa.
Syria and Africa, right? We're in between, geologically. So one of the things that can happen, okay, is an expectation, for example, deep rest retreat. Okay, I'm gonna go and I'm gonna find the magic button and I'm gonna find the way to turn it off. And I'm gonna have a few days where I'm off. And then I'm gonna be rested and that's gonna be nice. And then we try resting, and sometimes it's possible to rest. Woohoo! And of course, at first, what we find when we rest is how tired we are, and we feel more tired, and we rest maybe some more. And we hear, well, they're all snoring, so maybe it's okay. Even the teacher is snoring, so okay. Let's just try a little longer. And And by the way, or whatever posture you feel is deeper for you, you do that, but maybe more restfully. Maybe you're trying another experiment from what you've tried before.
Can you repeat what you said?
Which part?
The last sentence.
I said, so, or by the way, you might feel like sitting because that feels deeper for you. So whatever posture feels deeper for anyone, that's what we're asking you to experiment with. But maybe while sitting, you're trying out how it is to practice with a different approach or attitude more restfully. And what happens when we start to find how to turn something off or not listen to it so much, turn off the way of listening, volume down, or we don't even know exactly how we do rest, actually, which is interesting too. But what happens when we rest, after we got tired and rested some more, is that we have some energy. We don't know how. We don't know how that happens. And so that's one first part of how we start to find that a path of ease has its difficulties. And in fact, the more we can bring ease into the path, the more we find a readiness, a willingness, and a capacity for the difficult. For the difficult. Which is not the same as a hunger for the difficult. Where I want to gnaw on the bone of difficulty to prove to myself that I have the right to exist. Okay, so sometimes on retreat, there's a kind of restlessness because we want some challenge and they're just saying relax and relax more, these ladies. And I remember on one retreat in Israel, someone came to talk to me and was saying, yes, but when we sit and my knee hurts and I don't want to just avoid that challenge, that difficulty, because it's like preparation for the difficulty of life. Which in this context sounds funny, but in a regular retreat, in a consensus reality retreat, that is the norm. Why does it sound funny here? What I said to him is, are you interested in superficial? He said, if I run away from the knee pain, something like, how will I be able to handle it or be ready for when the shit hits the fan? Which is a wonderful metaphor. The shit hits the fan. Is a phrase in English that he knew. And my question was, are you interested in superficial shit or deep shit? Because it takes energy to be with the knee pain that you wouldn't have if you stretched your leg out or put a cushion under your knee or sat a little higher or were lying down. And there's going to come something difficult that you can not run from. So our love of challenge and adventure will have plenty to be with. It's not an either or, challenging or ease, turn off or turn on. And so in one way, in answer to the question of how do we feel the difference between the two kinds of difficulty, is really simple and experiential. We can feel if there's food here or if it's an empty bone. And there's a wonderful, terrible image that I'm sure I've given on retreat here before in Israel from my favorite book, the Yog Vashisht, a Sanskrit text. And it's just wonderful to think of 1,000 years ago people being willing to put into Sanskrit this wonderful, terrible image of us. The metaphor is a dog, which in India, dogs, there's a lot of not just ambivalence about dogs. Dogs kind of are a sign of trouble. So already it's a dog. And the dog is chewing a bone, and the bone has nothing left on it or in it. It's so dry that it's sharp, and it's cutting the mouth of the dog, and the dog has a taste of blood and keeps chewing. It's just a metaphor for addiction, for our capacity to be addictive. And so something reminds us of food and we keep chewing. But it's actually a waste of our own lifeblood to give ourselves an artificial challenge. There are so many real challenges. But we do have to. I don't like to say have to, but we do. And we can take seriously this puzzle. Take seriously the power of our interest in the bone, the dry bone. The power of our fascination with being occupied with artificial challenge. And so one kind of sign, inner sign, that we can notice is simply that my approach is I'm oriented about a problem. I'm inspired because there's a problem, I'm reacting. With alarm. But it's not that as we start to learn how to bring our alarm system down, it's not then that, oh, it's so easy. And so it's another confusion that we kind of hit. Isn't this the path of deep rest and being in touch with aliveness? Why am I struggling? When I'm being moved by my heart, or I'm being moved not because of an idea, not because of a should or a have to. If we could notice, it could be even worth taking a whole day to make a category of our thoughts. Because we have this identification of wanting to be independent and go with my own way of thinking. How much of your thinking is your own? Out of all of our thoughts, where is one that didn't come from somewhere else? It could be a good thought, a helpful thought, or an unhelpful thought, an eating you up inside thought. Boring thought, whatever. But it's not that we disengage from that old bone thinking and we're moved by a tender heart and we're finding our flow. It's not that it's easy. And it's not also that it gets easier and easier and easier. And the part of us that's looking for what would just get easier and easier is the part that's afraid and feels small and separate and wants to be saved, which we can acknowledge. We can feel when that's operating and kind of take it up into our arms and let it keep kicking and just hold it. Keep holding it lovingly. Or let it run around, but you're kind of keeping an eye that it doesn't hurt itself. It's also not that if we're thinking of devotion, and we're going against cultural norms to be moved in some other way that we can't explain. So people might ask, so what do you practice? You love meditation. What do you practice? And your genuine response is that you don't know. You have no words. In it might be worthwhile to just have a phrase that you can give out. It might not be worthwhile to tell everyone who asks you. Not that maybe many people ask you, but at least to keep an honesty with ourselves that it can be a good situation. That I don't want to define meditation. And I'm aware that there's a lot that I don't know, and some of that I might come to know, and some of it might be unknown, unknowable. And that's where the word devotion is really helpful, because there's a sense of following, but also a kind of leadership. We're following a kind of inner leadership, an inner scent trail is how I like to think of it. So with devotion, we would tend to think of it as being smaller, less than, less powerful, not knowing, and following someone or something that is more complete and knows more, etc., is more expert, etc. And we follow that. But I don't think that's devotion. Or it's not maybe the full picture of devotion. I find devotion to be something else, where there is an inner leadership that's gentle and has a different kind of way of being clear. It's not like looking at a map and planning out the route in advance and telling, okay, everybody, this way, like army. It's not army clear. It's feeling our way along clear. It's trusting a process where we can feel our pipes are getting cleaned and our heart starts to be unbearably clear and clean. But it doesn't mean that I see where I'm going next, even with inner eyes. I might get a glimpse, I might not. So I think maybe, I don't want to define it too carefully, how to tell the difference between this kind of suffering and that kind of suffering. And if suffering apparently originally meant just undergoing, going through, undergoing, but I think undergoing is a better way. Really going under, going through the underground passage where we feel our way along blindly. Something is leading the way that's not out there. But there's something in us that's not alone, that's pulling, able to pull along through gentleness, an attraction of gentleness, that can feel its way along an underground tunnel. So, but maybe one way to feel, I wonder if this kind of suffering is the dog with the bone, or I wonder if this kind of suffering is like a plant in the desert coming up anyway. I think maybe if, like, the star of the show is me, and either how terrible I am or whatever, then it's probably the bone. And if I'm not so much the star of the show, because I really know that I don't know, and I including don't even know what my place is in this following along thing, and in this kind of rhyming with, like a devotional pull. Okay, so one thing I wanted to mention, especially if you're doing lying down practice, and also if you're doing other postures, but let's just, I'll speak in terms of lying down. We can be feeling the ground, letting the back be wide and long, alive. I loved Odelia G's statement in yoga this morning, that feeling as if part of ourself is behind us, and maybe even with hands on our own back. So the back is really soft, alive, full. And there's room for the thoughts, there's room for the programming and emotion and mind states, body sensations and sounds. And there's a noticing that it's easy for the habituated thoughts and feelings to happen again and again. And we're feeling for what I call already awareness, so where it's not me trying to feel my feet or my belly or my back, but noticing that it already feels itself. And so let's say that the lower belly feels like a calm, alive ground to come to. And so it would be as if, let's say, many people prefer to lie on their back in the hall. I highly recommend also lying face down sometimes, by the way. But okay, we're lying on our back. And maybe hands on the belly or not. But a sense of as if the belly is the bottom of the ocean floor, and the sand is kind of as if it gathers itself together in a little spot or mound, a tiny little hill, quietly feeling itself. And we're almost aware of some kind of sustaining or continuity, even though the mind is definitely moving around. But there's something quietly sustaining, a gathered in the belly, not airtight. So just as a kind of guideline for practice, when you're not asleep and you're lying down, that could be a way. And it's kind of allowed to happen in a way that doesn't block what could be your innate, own, organic, emerging way of meditating. It's not like sitting there on top of a hole, like to replace your own way. It's sort of almost, well, for now, as we let our own original path start to gather momentum, might as well gather, let the belly be magnetic. And notice how it feels itself and how that leaves a lot of space. Okay? Is that clear? Not clear? Is there any question about that? Yes, please. Yeah.
Requiring a certain technique or a certain path.
Yeah.
What you're saying, there's not a way, there's not a technique, or what you're guiding is to be, it's kind of what is right for you in the process.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's if I stuck it together as a question, but maybe you understand
what I mean. Yeah. Yeah, the words trust your process have come up many times today with people. And so even if we keep the metaphor of, which would be, even could be a story, if someone wants needs some water, and so they're digging a hole to find water, to make a well, and they dig a little here, they dig a little there, they dig a little there, they're digging all the time and no water. So with the word devotion and the idea of digging a well, what are we devoted to? Is my devotion or my loyalty or my interest in the technique that worked for someone else? Is my devotion, my loyalty, my interest, my transformative edge, my contact with aliveness, something that doesn't mind throwing away that technique, throwing away that shovel, because we're digging here. Digging is going on. And I'm going to use whatever helps me dig a hole, because I really need water. And so it's partly a discovery that I need water and that something in me knows how to dig and is digging. And I can stop interfering by saying, no, dear, keep using, use this shovel, use this shovel. We're supposed to use this shovel. This shovel doesn't work on rock. It worked on sand. It was great for sand. Okay, I want to tell a story, finally. It's actually a legend. Possibly true story.
Can I ask something about what you said about the tummy?
Okay.
Before you move to the story.
Okay.
You said it's an example. So you could have chose another part of the body to focus on.
Mm-hmm.
But what happens if your consciousness moves to another part of the body? Do you bring it back to this area that you chose to focus on, or you just let it wander around the body and dump it?
Yeah. Are you one of the people who has trouble making decisions?
Yes.
So it's just kind of knowing that. It can be interesting to play on both sides. So play with sticking to the one, probably more often, but not to the point of bringing out a rebellion. Like there's something about being open that's helpful. And then there's the way that, what about this? What about maybe this? Maybe over here, maybe over there, that's interference. And so we want to keep experimenting and getting the actual contact so that we get a feeling for what is the helpful openness and what is the interference, the yes-no barrier. And then there will come times where you can feel that it's an organic, okay, the lower belly with the out breath or with the breath. And it's not a traveling, it's not a bone. It's a staying true too. It's part of the digging for water. The belly is good also, by the way, if you're not sure, for people who aren't sure, so try the belly. Once upon a time, there was a family of washer people. They did the laundry of everyone in the village. And it's interesting how sometimes just daily life, so the work of doing laundry at that time meant having a donkey, going through the village and picking up the dirty clothes and sheets and so on, packing them onto the donkey so we can carry it down to the riverside. And it happens in the riverside as it is a particular geology. And they're cool rocks. And so the people in this washer family, let's say one of the children, found this amazing, beautiful rock. Wow, look at this rock. And everyone thought it was beautiful. So beautiful that they tied it around the neck of their donkey. And it made them happy to see it there. It made them smile. It felt like a playful thing to do. Not everybody would just pick up a rock and tie it around the neck of their donkey, decorate their donkey. I want to already just kind of bring in one way that we can apply this to meditation practice. Having our job be the washer family is that kind of attitude where I have to work to earn my place. I've got to be busy cleaning, and it never ends. There's always more dirty laundry. And so I've got to always keep working, or I don't have a place. But even so, having that particular job brings us to that particular place, and we find this really cool rock. And we're together, and it's not bad work. We're in the water, etc. And so back and forth to the village in the evening, bringing the laundry back to the houses, and again the next morning the same. Early morning, under the stars, starting to get up, go through the village, collect the laundry, down to the river. It's beautiful. We can accept this lifestyle. And we see the rock on the donkey's neck, and it makes us smile. But we notice that time is passing. Life is passing. One evening on the way back, satisfied from a good day's work, tired, hungry, coming across someone on the road, and they're kind of a high and mighty type. So we just kind of stay on the side because we're the lowly type. And we want to let them pass so we can kind of, come on, get out of the way. We want to get home. We're tired. We're hungry. But instead, this fancy, rich guy in a carriage stops right in the middle of our way. And we're like, you have to stop here? And the guy gets out of the carriage and looks quite excited, trying to act calm. And goes straight to the donkey. And says, could I buy your donkey? I'll give you 100. The donkey is worth 20. But we need the donkey for our work. What are we going to do here? Okay, I'll give you 1,000. Yeah. That would give us enough to buy a few donkeys. Okay, all right. You can have the donkey. And then the guy says, actually, I don't even really need the donkey. And he takes the rock and he gets into the carriage and he's gone. And a few months later, there's a big kerfuffle. There's a big happening. A messenger from the emperor is coming to this very village. And they want to see this very washer family. And the washer family's like, oh my God, what did we do wrong? We must be in trouble if the emperor has sent someone. So it turns out that the guy, the rich guy from the carriage, was a diamond merchant and recognized the rock on the donkey's neck as the biggest diamond that has ever been found. The possibility that this is a true story. It could happen. And when the merchant presented this big diamond to the emperor, because in those days, if you didn't, you would be in trouble. And if you did, you'd get some reward. So the merchant took the big diamond to the emperor. And the emperor was a just person, though an emperor, which is an unjust position, but anyway. Where did you get this thing? How much did you pay for it? And realized that the washer people needed to be included in the abundance of this situation. The biggest diamond that had ever been found. So first of all, a diamond is something, we can make them, but they're not as valuable when we make them. They're more valuable when they're found, naturally made. All along, we have this rock on the neck of our donkey. So if the rock, the diamond, the most precious thing in the whole empire, something in us that's childlike does recognize it right away and does want to keep it close. We want to have it nearby while we're working away to make a living. And we don't even know the irony of our own situation. We're working away and we have the most valuable piece of property on the neck of the donkey. So the diamond, one way of feeling into the story is the diamond is, and our response to it, is our love of the unconditioned that we talked about the first night. We don't know why we like it. We don't know how we know we like it. We're not quite sure what it is or how to go about liking it. But something in us did and does recognize it. And might need some other kind of eyes of experience and honoring or reverence to make our life organize around that. Because otherwise life is passing and we do have the diamond. And we could organize our life around it. Do you know what I mean?
No.
So, anyone over these last couple of days have a sense of, okay, maybe this is that experience of yes to the unconditioned in the conditions. I don't know. There's something spacious as I stand and see the sky. Anyone? Hello?
Yes.
Yes?
Yes.
So I asked you about happy, unhappy, and asked you about joy. Words could be like, without confining what we're talking about only to wonder or awe or yes or quietness, but okay, so I can't see who you are, but could you please describe anything about that experience of loving the unconditioned or receiving the unconditioned or whatever? Mm-hmm. It may not come words, but if it does, it would be lovely.
Quiet.
Quiet. Did you feel a texture of quiet in the body somehow? Or how was it?
Expansion.
Expansion.
Like clouds.
Like clouds. Okay. Did you feel that, if I say where, did you feel expansion? Does that make sense at all?
Around your chest.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Anything else? Not into words, yeah. Okay. Anyone else?
Yes. Although it's hard to put into words.
Mm-hmm. Take your time.
Well, the feeling is like an expanding gratitude.
Mm-hmm.
Like a sense of kind of, yeah.
A sense of, sorry?
Gratitude.
Mm-hmm.
Like gratitude expanding away from my center into something that's around me and bigger than me.
Mm-hmm. What does gratitude feel like? How do you feel gratitude?
It's the sense of expansion.
Okay, and is there anything anymore other than expansion that comes across as a texture or movement or it's like silk or it's like...
I can feel it in my throat.
Mm.
And around my chest, and it's it has a particular quality of moving outward.
Mm-hmm.
I can't say what texture it has.
Okay. Great, thank you. So we could start to think that if only I could acknowledge that, if I could register, I could know what I know. If only I could get to know that feeling of response of yes to the unconditioned, then it would be easy. But what I started to say earlier also about devotion, about some kind of inner leadership that doesn't feel like a leader. And it's lovely to follow. Everything else feels lovely following that kind of friendly leadership. But it's not that we just instantly know it and are expert. It's a gradual process of learning by mistakes and learning by not knowing. So, for example, now you can start to feel, is there a texture? But not in a way that's like infecting you with doubt or anxiety or I've got to find out, but just, oh, maybe that is unknown could be more known by leaving room for the feeling to feel. Maybe I'm allowed to be more familiar with gratitude, even though I know I can't keep it or make it stay or make it come back, but here it is and I could give into it. And as if that's endless, endlessly more, infinitely more intimacy with the yes to life. And being led by that yes to life, which would be devotion.
But I have a question about this.
Just 1 second. I want to feel there's something.
Sorry. That particular quality, which I described, is... Not common. It is quite uncommon. It is why it is easy for me to remember, because it kind of appeared at peaks in my life. And then it was distinct. But on a daily basis, it doesn't appear as such.
Yeah.
So it's more, so looking for it can become an addiction, a bone.
Yeah.
searching for such peaks, such heightened peaks of gratitude, you know?
Yeah.
We are coming back to the subject of devotion.
Yeah. And so it's good to bring out this, how it doesn't work to look for those particular sensations or those particular signs of past experience of gratitude. Those that particular angle of the diamond or whatever. But we still have the diamond. So it can be important to keep in mind that we're working with, let's say, whatever it is enough. Whatever we have to go on is enough. What if? So that little bit of a sense of maybe that's a whisper of a response to the unconditioned. Maybe that's a little bit of a sense of love, of aliveness. Or just, or just willingness to be surprised. Or willingness to be really simple. To shift from will to willingness. To shift from the focus on looking for what I don't have to being open to what I need and love. To letting the need find what it needs and getting out of the way. But if we have this metaphor of the child sees the cool rock and picks it up, it can help us be open to kind of eventually let it come across to us. It's our own non-receptivity that's in the way. It's not our fault that we're not receptive, but we are not receptive. But in moments in our life, a child picked up a rock. There was a natural appreciation and action. That when we're quiet, when we're in quietness long enough, it'll really be knocking on the door. And eventually we'll kind of realize, oh, that's actual knocking on the door. I guess, oh, could I open that door? Am I allowed to open that my own door? Huh. Why wouldn't I? Of course. Okay, I'll go open that door. So even though it's a natural response that's in us, we unnaturally are blocked to allowing it or even recognizing it, much less honoring it and making it the center of our life. Does that make sense?
I didn't hear what you said last. Making it, what did you say, the very last something?
Anybody?
The center of our life.
Making it, okay, thank you. I got it.
And so it's something that then could again be spontaneous and fresh, even though there's all this work to dig, to unbury, to get out of the way. What is the yes, no? To get out of the way, our fencing, our defense, our troubling ourselves. So that's what I have to say now. Why don't we just have a moment quiet before we start back? even just now in the moment, letting your body and mind organize around. Or just having that in mind, the possibility of an alignment. And at the center of that is that maybe that's a yes to life. That's not me doing it. It's already here. And already lovely. And already bright. And already unbreakable, unshakable. But not easy to stay with, stay true to. May all beings live with joy, lightly on the earth, in friendship with all beings, including ourselves. May our practice and lives be in alignment with what's most important as a momentum towards awakening for all, including ourselves.